approaching the tail end of a segment of that that's dealing with the church's parables, or the parables that Jesus gave in the Gospels there, and looking at them. This morning we'll be looking at two parables that are related in a sense. I want to remind you, as we begin, of the purpose of a parable. Jesus told his disciples that the reason that he spoke in parables was twofold. One, that those who he wanted to understand would understand, and those that he didn't want to understand would not understand. And as we look at parables, it's important to remember a basic idea and principle in looking at a parable, and that is to find the meaning of the parable, to find the point, not 5 points, but the one point that the speaker, in this case Jesus, is making with the parable. And you could take any parable and work it to death as far as making this little idea represent this and this little point represent that, and come up with a thousand different ideas of what's going on there. But the idea is to find the point of the parable and be careful in not going beyond that, trying to make it mean more than it was intended to mean. This morning, the parables that we're going to look at, I have struggled with these more than any that we've come across so far. And several months ago, I put together this outline and I assigned the text, and it's commonly believed that I kind of manipulated the schedule so that I would get the ones that I wanted and leave the hard ones to Tony and DeRay. And I'm going to plead the fifth on that charge. But it didn't work out in this particular case. This was a difficult passage for me to look at, and we're going to look at these two parables. Let's begin in Matthew chapter 22. We're going to look at the first 14 verses. Matthew chapter 22, verses 1 to 14. It says, "And Jesus answered and spoke to them again in parables, saying, The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who gave a wedding feast for his son. And he sent out his slaves to call those who had been invited to the wedding feast, and they were unwilling to come. Again, he sent out other slaves, saying, Tell those who have been invited, Behold, I prepared my dinner, my oxen, my fatted livestock are all butchered, and everything is ready. Come to the wedding feast. But they paid no attention and went their way, one to his farm, another to his business, and the rest seized his slaves and mistreated them and killed them. But the king was enraged and sent his armies and destroyed those murderers and set their city on fire. Then said he to the slaves, The wedding is ready, but those who were invited were not worthy. Go therefore to the main highways, and as many as you find there, invite to the wedding feast. And those slaves went out into the streets and gathered together all they found, both evil and good, and the wedding hall was filled with dinner guests. But when the king came in to look over the dinner guests, he saw there a man not dressed in wedding clothes. And he said to him, Friend, how did you come in here without wedding clothes? And he was speechless. Then the king said to the servants, Bind him hand and foot and cast him into the outer darkness. In that place there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. For many are called, but few are chosen. I want you to listen as I read that. I get to the end of those verses. I want to say, give this guy a break. Now, I want to retell this story in the picture that it has always painted in my mind. And you're going to need to listen for a little bit. I want to retell the story and the picture that this is always, that I see in my mind as I read these verses. And I'll tell you up front, I believe that it's a wrong picture. But nevertheless, here is kind of what I see as I read this. Here's this king. He's going to give a wedding for his son. And so he invites all these people, kind of pre-invites them, lets them know, there's a wedding coming up, I want you to come to the wedding for my son. As the time draws near, the king sends out his servants to remind everyone of the exact time, everything's ready, come. This one person can't come, or doesn't want to come. And I, in my mind, I look at that, I say, what's wrong with that? If I don't want to go to a wedding, do I have to go to a wedding? I'm working, I've got a business, I go to my farm, take care of all this. They don't want to come. The king is angry. He gets mad because people don't want to come to his wedding. So he sends out his servants, and I can see his servants just on pins and needles around this angry king. And one servant may say, you know, you go in and tell him that they won't come. I don't want to go in there and risk his wrath. So the servants are there, and the king says, go out and find anyone. Look in the highways, the byways, the gutters, the streets, wherever you may find someone. Get some people here for my son's wedding. So the servants go out and they grab the first person they see on the street. Say, hey, you know, drop what you're doing. Come to this wedding. You know, get free food. You know, come in. The king's having a wedding. Please come. It might mean my head if I can't get people to come to this wedding. So they hastily gather all these people in. And then the king comes in, looks them over, and just picks out some guy. He says, what's the deal with you? Look at the trashy looking clothes you have on. Get him out of here. And the guy was just pulled in off the street. I don't know if that's how you look at this or not, but that's the picture that it leaves in my mind. And here's a parable. And I told you before I told you this, I think that is terribly erroneous picture that's in that I've painted for you. So what is the point of the parable? The statement you see on the outline, if you've grabbed an outline, is this, that we should respond to the king with respect and humility. Now you can read the parable, and there's always this great conflict in my mind because, you know, I can read the parable and I can know. I can understand that this king is a reference to God. And I can understand that the Son is Jesus Christ. And I can see that the parable is making a point of God the Father inviting those to come to his Son. Come to the wedding, and they would not come. And we can see, and then he says, go into the highway. And you can see that those who would not come, you know, once you know a little bit about the New Testament, is probably a reference to the Jews. He came unto his own, but his own received him not. So he goes to the highways, goes to the Gentiles, goes to those who are considered unclean by the Jews. And fills his wedding table from those. You know, I can see that. And so it conflicts with this picture that's painting in my that I'm painting in my mind about God and about the parable, excuse me. Now I want us to look at the context of this parable. And we don't find that in Matthew, you'll find it in Luke, and I'm not you don't have to turn there, but I want to point out a couple of things from that. Jesus prior to this, it seems, has been invited to a dinner at the house of the Pharisees or the publicans or the religious leaders of the day, I believe it was. And Jesus was watching. Apparently it was a big event. And Jesus is watching how they go about interacting with one another and how they go about deciding who is going to sit where. And Jesus, in the course of this interaction here, teaches his disciples something. And he says to his disciples, listen, when you go to a big shindig and you want to have the best seat, you want to be the most important person, to sit in the where the important people sit, take heed to what you're doing. What's going to happen if you go up and get one of the best chairs and then some important people come in and they ask you to move? You're going to be embarrassed. You're going to be put to shame. What you ought to do is to initiate sitting in the lowest seats. Sit at the back. Or sit, you know, wherever it would be that the more common people would sit. And then if they call you forward to sit in a better seat, it'll be better. But if you try to exalt yourself, you might just find yourself humiliated. But if you will be a humble person, humiliate yourself, you might be exalted. And he goes on and says, furthermore, when you have a feast, when you have a big dinner, don't just invite people who can reciprocate the event for you. In other words, don't just invite people who will have a dinner later on and invite you. Don't be the type of person that I'll scratch your back and then you scratch my back. But rather, when you have a feast, invite those people who cannot have a feast for you in return. Invite those people who are not in a position to do you favors. And then your reward will be in heaven. And the disciples then make this comment. And you remember, the disciples kind of have this problem. We saw this several weeks ago with kind of wanting to be the top dog themselves. They're always worried about who's going to be sit at the right hand of Jesus in the kingdom and who's going to sit at his left hand in the kingdom and who is going to be the greatest among the 12 there. And so they're already thinking like the world thinks. And so when Jesus tells them these little tidbits of wisdom, you know, they say, well, it'd be great for that person in the kingdom of heaven then. If we invite the poor and the downtrodden to our feast and get reward in heaven, they don't see the good that they do for the poor and downtrodden. What they're looking at is the reward that I would get at a feast in heaven. And then Jesus tells them the story. He tells them this parable about the wedding feast. And it changes their focus off of what can this do for me to what kind of response should a person have to a king who invites them to a banquet or to a wedding. And that's the point. The point is that when we are invited, when we are bidden by the King of Kings to come somewhere, to do something, what should be our response to him? Our response should be one of respect and humility. The king has invited these people, and God invites you and I at times to participate in his glory, to participate in his joy. And we are bidden to come. Notice the guy that came with no wedding garments. And here again, my picture was erroneous. I think that what really is taking place here is the people have time to prepare. It's not like the dinner is on the table getting cold. It's they have time to prepare themselves to come at the king's bidding. And rather than come with respect and to come prepared, even with the proper kind of attire, the guy did not. You know, I was thinking yesterday as I was thinking about this, when our boys were small, and they were boys, you know, we lived out in the country and they played out in the yard and dug holes all over our yard and done all kinds of these things. And so their pants ended up having, you know, holes in the knees and little cuts here and there, you know. And Susan, this was one thing that it wasn't a battle, but one way mine and Susan's ideas about things were different. And as usual, she kind of got her way. But when they would get ready to go to town, the boys could have on a pair of clean blue jeans, but they might have a hole in the knee and they'd have changed clothes. They were not allowed to go to town with holy blue jeans on, or a t-shirt that might have a little tear right here. I mean, a little tear. You would change shirts, get on some good clothes, go to town. As soon as they got home from town, get out of their good clothes, put back on the t-shirt with a little cut in it, and go outside and play. Proper attire in her eyes. Well, you know, I've worked as a carpenter for 30 years that we've been married. And it is difficult for me to justify going to work every day with a pair of blue jeans on that does not have holes in them or does not have paint spots on it or some type of stain. Because just as sure as I put on a pair of nice-looking pants, when I get home, they're going to look like the ones I should have worn to start with. So when I go to work, usually I start out clean, but not just really nice clothes. And by the end of the day, not only are my clothes not look nice, I'm nasty as well. But if I were going to someone's house to eat supper or to talk to them about a job or whatever, I'd get cleaned up and put on a different kind of shirt and a different kind of clothes. When I come to church, I wear ties. Can I take this off now? Oh, that was my object lesson. But responding to God, responding to the bidding of a king with the proper spirit. It is not so much the clothes that we might wear, but it is the spirit with which we respond to God. It is the spirit with which we respond to what God is calling us to do. And that's what the point of this parable is. When God the Father bids us to come, when God the Father bids us to do this or to do that, how is it that we approach that? How is it that we respond to that? We are to respond with respect. We are to respond with humility. And also, being comfortable with God's expectations. With God the Father. Let's look at the second parable. Here we are in Matthew chapter 25. We'll read verses 14 to 30. Matthew chapter 25, verses 14 to 30. Verse 14 says, "For it is just like a man about to go on a journey, who called his own slaves and entrusted his possessions to them. And to one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, each according to his own ability, and he went on his journey. Now let's make sure we catch a couple of things here. Here's a man who has people who work for him, people who he is intending that they might make him a prophet. And he's about to go on a journey, and he leaves in this particular case, he's mentioned 3 of his employees, 3 of his servants, with tasks to do. And notice it says he leaves them according to their abilities. One person is more capable of doing something, so you give them more responsibility. Another person might be a little less capable, you give them less responsibility. A person who is the least capable, you give them the least responsibility. So we see that in verse 15. Verse 16. Immediately the one who had received the 5 talents went and traded with them and gained 5 more talents. So he doubled his money, right? Verse 17, in the same manner, the one who had received 2 talents gained 2 more. He doubled his money. Now, we would assume that the guy who had 5 was more capable because the guy gave them according to their abilities, but the return on the money was the same. The guy who had 2 made just as much percentage-wise as the guy who had been given 5. Verse 18, but he who had received the 1 talent went away and dug in the ground and hid his master's money. Now after a long time, the master of those slaves came and settled accounts with them. And the one who had received the 5 talents came and brought 5 more talents, saying, Master, you entrusted 5 talents to me. See, I have gained 5 more talents. His master said to him, Well done, good, faithful slave. You are faithful in a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. The one also had received the 2 talents came up and said, Master, you entrusted to me 2 talents. See, I've gained 2 more talents. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful slave. You are faithful in a few things. I'll put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. The one also who had received the 1 talent came up and said, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow, and gathering where you scattered no seed. And I was afraid, and went away and hid your talent in the ground. See, you have what is yours. But his master answered and said to him, You wicked, lazy slave, you knew that I reap where I did not sow, and gather where I scattered no seed. Then you ought to have put my money in the bank, and on my arrival I would receive my money back with interest. Therefore take away the talent from him, and give it to the one who has the 10 talents. For to everyone who has shall more be given, and he shall have an abundance. But from the one who does not have, even what he does have shall be taken away. And cast out the worthless slave into outer darkness. In that place there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Again, I read that, and I think to myself, give this guy a break. And again, I want to retell the story and paint a picture in your mind of how it is in my own. And again, I tell you, this is not right, but this is the way I tend to look at this. When I read this, here's this man, a wealthy man, a man of influence, a powerful man, a man who knows how to throw his weight around. And he goes on a trip, on a journey, and puts his employees in charge of making him some profit while he's gone. Here's one guy that is capable, he's proven himself, his ability, so he gives him 5 talents to invest, to make money. Here's another fella that's kind of a run of the mill. He gives him 2 talents and expects him to make money with that. Here's another fellow who is just barely hanging on. He gives him one. While he's gone, the guy who has the five talents takes some risk and invests his money and doubles his money. The guy who has two talents invests the money, doubles his. The guy who had one is fearful. What is he afraid of? He's afraid of his boss. He's afraid of his master. And he's afraid, if I lose this talent, if I invest this amount of money that he's given me and I lose it and I lose money on it, he's not going to be happy. He's going to be irate. I will lose my job, maybe my head. And so he buries it and hides what he's been given in the ground so that he can keep it safe and give it to his master when he returns. The master comes back and is going through with his servants, and he's proud of the servant who gained five talents. You did good. I'll put you in charge of greater things. Notice, he does not say, I'll let you rest and glory in the praise that I'm giving you. No, you did good. Now, let's assign you some other tasks to make me more money. The fellow who gained the two, same thing. Good job. Here's you some more work to do. Then the guy that had the one comes trembling and quivering before him. Here's your one talent. I did not lose it. I knew you were a hard man. And I knew, now notice this is the picture is painting in my mind. It's not what the text says, the picture that's in my mind. I knew you were to take advantage of whoever you could take advantage of. I knew you would take whatever you could get off of whoever you could get it off of. And I was afraid to lose your talent. And the man said, you sorry bum. I gave you this expecting you to make something for me. You knew I wanted everything I could get. Get him out of here. Now here's a parable. And this is the picture I just painted for you is not the way we should look at this. And even if there are aspects of it that might be accurate, remember the parable is making a point. The parable is not to give us a picture of how God is. That's not the intent of the story. So don't look at this parable and say, God's an angry guy who just rips everybody off, doesn't treat his people fairly. That's not the point of the parable. So what is the point? On your outline, number two. As a general rule. Now those are four important words. As a general rule, we should be willing to take great risk to advance the kingdom of God. As a general rule, we should be willing to take great risk to advance the kingdom of God. And again, I want to tell you the context of this parable. And you won't find it in Matthew. Again, you'll find it in Luke. Jesus and his disciples are on their way to Jerusalem. Jesus' earthly ministry is drawing to an end. And he has thrown out these little tidbits of information to his disciples. A little bit here and a little bit there about the day coming when he must suffer. And he's done this five or six times over the past 3 years, and every time it seems to have just gone over their head. Because they have in their mind that when they go up to Jerusalem for the Passover, it is probably at this time that Jesus is going to set up his kingdom. And he's going to throw off the Roman rule that is oppressing the Jewish people. And they haven't quite got it in their head that this might not be what happens. And they're on their way to Jerusalem. The disciples are halfway expecting that this might be the time. And Jesus, we see in Luke, knowing their thoughts, Jesus, knowing kind of how that they're looking at this, tells them this story. Let me tell you a story about a man who went to a far country and left his servants here, expecting his servants in his absence to be about his business. Do you see the application there? Not of a king setting up a reign, but perhaps of a man, perhaps of Jesus being gone and leaving them there, expecting them to make an investment in his kingdom. Now, the point of the parable, I'm saying, is that God wants us to be willing to take great risk to advance his kingdom. All of us have abilities that differ one from another. My abilities are not to the extent of yours. My abilities may not be in the area that your abilities are. And likewise, you with one another. But all of us can give equal effort. All of us can equally give our all to the Lord and to advance his kingdom. Let's talk about taking risk. This morning, and after church, we're having a shower for Titus and Alicia, their new baby. Having a child is a risky thing, isn't it? When Susan was pregnant with Mark, our oldest son, she went into labor about 11 o'clock this one morning. I was in labor till about 8 the next morning when they finally did a C-section. Under 20 hours or so, she was in labor. And I remember at some point during that time when she was back in this room, back in the hospital, nobody was allowed back there but me and the nurse. And they were watching her, and all this stuff, and she's having contractions. And I remember at one point in my anxieties and in my fears and in my uneasiness of telling her, we won't have any more kids. This is enough. Three or four months later, I'd gotten over that. But the risk of something going wrong. And, when you're right in the middle of labor and contractions and all those things, there is only one solution, isn't there? There's only one way to fix that, and that's the baby to be born. And the anxiety is there, and the fear is there. And then the baby is born and everything is fine and the joy. It's just like something totally different, isn't it? The fear is gone. And now here is the joy of holding this new life. That's a risk that, as a general rule, people find themselves willing to take. And for a Christian, it should be even more so. God has called us as His people to have families. But you know, there are a few people, and I don't know very many, but I know a few who it seems to me that I know that are just simply not willing to take that risk. They're married. They're capable of having children, but there's something about that risk. And maybe it's just the dollars. I don't know. But they're just simply not willing to take that risk. A risk that, as a general rule, God calls us to take. Think of marriage. Just marriage. What an incredible risk that is. DJ and Allison got married last Sunday. Do you know what a risk they are taking? You do. They don't know, but you know, right? When I got married, I couldn't even contemplate the idea that this might not work. I couldn't contemplate the idea that there may be trouble. You know, we were in love. What else could there be? But getting married, there is something about that that you expose yourself. You make yourself totally vulnerable to another person. It's like you take out your soul unprotected and lay it before them. That's an incredible risk. And most people are hurt as a result of taking that risk, aren't they? At some point, that person that you have given yourself to, it's like they take a knife and just tear you apart. What a risk. And yet, as a general rule, God calls us to take that risk. God has made us where that we are willing to take that risk, and the benefits of taking it can far outweigh the risk. That's why we take it. We anticipate that. What about other things that God may have called us to take risk? What about business? The way you handle your money. God has called us. You know, I'm not a financial guy, but I just want to kind of just throw this idea out for you. I do a lot of watching, folks. You know, I watch the people I know, just kind of watch how they are, how they think about things, how they respond to certain things. And I've noticed that there are people, just in playing games. You know, we play games. You know, if I play Monopoly with you, I won't, but if I were to, I'd be borrowed to the hilt. Because it doesn't bother me to take a risk playing a game. How many of you know how to play hearts? Several of you, if you don't know how to play hearts, you won't probably understand this. But when I play hearts, I start out every hand trying to catch them all. Every hand. And if we're playing with Susan, somebody else, she constantly warning everybody else we're playing, he's going to try to get them all. He's going to try to get them all. And if I have to cheat to do it, I'll cheat to do it. But there are some people whose makeup, they are not risk takers, and even playing a simple game that doesn't matter a hoot. They will not take a risk playing a game. I can't understand that. But we're not talking about games. We're talking about real life. You have money. You know what the CDs are drawing now? 1%? Maybe? 1% on your money. What is inflation? 4 or 5%. So that means if I've got, and y'all, I'm not a business guy, y'all tell me if this is not, I'm not thinking right. If I have money in a CD, at the end of a year, my buying power is less than it was when I put it in there. Why would I put it in there? Because it's safe. I mean, I don't have any CDs, but that's the reason people do, is because they know. They know that they're giving away 2 or 3% on their money, but they will not do anything else with it because they will not take the risk. Now, I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm just saying that's the way some people are. Advancing God's kingdom. We have Marshall and John go to Burma. That's not like going to Little Rock, is it? There are risks that we take, and they take, I shouldn't say we take, they take every year when they go to Burma. Risk that they might not come back. There are risks that are taken when the teams go to Guatemala. There are risks that we take in doing a lot of things that if we took the safe route, maybe we wouldn't do. But God has called us to be willing to take some risk to advance His kingdom. As Gerald, I don't mean to say you just got to go out and behave unwisely. But there are things that God has called us to do, and many of them are risky endeavors. And yet the returns are well worth the risk. That is what He's teaching here. The man goes on the journey and he expects, God expects, as we await His return, to come back and find us profitable servants for His kingdom. How are you with that? Do we just take the safe route, or are we willing and consciously taking risks that God's name might be honored? People might know Him. Let's pray. Father, as we think of these things, God, I know in my own life, in my own heart, it's just easier sometimes to do nothing than to risk being misunderstood, to risk being perhaps wasting my time. Lord, to risk being ridiculed, to risk some money that your name might be known. Father, would we be able to see ourselves as Your servants? Would You burn within our hearts the call that You have upon our lives, the expectations? God, glorify Your name. Make it known through our lives. Amen.